Now, in the political movement and struggle for Aboriginal communities to regain control over their community's traditional territories and to achieve sustainable local government, a lot of Aboriginal groups have entered into one type of alliance or not with many different non-Indigenous communities. One of the types of alliances over the last several decades that have been a particularly poignant and strong are alliances with various different types of green or ecology movements. Everywhere from the war in the woods in the 70s and 80s to the contemporary fights right now around the oil and gas transmission lines, you see these kinds of alliances and linkages forming up. I'll mention something as we go on a little bit later about, for example, Kakatla's own alliances with a nature of different environmental funding organizations to propel its legal claims against the Crown over the Enbridge oil pipeline decision. We'll come to that a little bit later. But these kind of ecological alliances aren't the only ones. We've also seen First Nations communities form joint ventures with various types of businesses. And sometimes they're criticized by the wider public, sometimes they're lauded. And we'll explore that a little bit later, this kind of dynamic. Now, I think it's important to kind of background that you have within the contemporary environmental movement, there often is a particular notion of Indigenous communities as in some sense being natural ecologists. And there actually is a penalty if an Indigenous community shifts outside of that zone of imagined natural ecology. So First Nations people, from this perspective, and I want to point out that it's one that I'm critical of, just so you know that as I'm going through here, but from this perspective, First Nations people are seen as being intimately linked with nature in a way which makes them, quote-unquote, spiritual and or the ecological guardian par excellence. This image is a figment of the colonial imagination. It's a particular component of a colonial ideology in which First Nations people are naturalized as part of the environment. Who's seen the Disney comic Pocahontas? You've all seen that young woman as she sort of flits and flows in and out of the woods, sort of her structure, her face, the coloring that the animators have given to her, this sort of natural flow through. And it's not until the rather Disney version is a little bit more comic than the historic version, but nonetheless, this dashing young white man sees her and pulls her forth into civilization. To sum up a long story, and hopefully not to dash anyone's conceptions of this beautiful fair-chosen fairy tale. But the point is that the Indigenous people, like Pocahontas, are presented as naturalized out of time, out of place, and a part of this kind of natural history. Hence, for many, many years, the typical places Indigenous peoples were lodged were in museums of natural history. What better place to lodge an Indigenous community than beside, say, the evolution of rocks, gems, birds, plants, other animals? That is a sarcastic statement. Sometimes, I do realize, sometimes my sarcasm is understood as straight-ahead prose. It's not. So there's a problem with that conceptualization, which is part of the way in which the ecological Indian emerges out of that kind of naturalized viewpoint. We can just think right here of a number of range of comments. When Macaw went whaling, PAWS, what were they called? The Progressive Animal Welfare Society castigated Macaw because they happened to have, this is a horrible crime, a well electrically lit tennis court. That showed a violation or deviation from cultural authenticity, therefore invalidating Macaw's claim to a natural native hunting of whales. Now, there are other issues. They were very concerned about sentient cetaceans and the hunting thereof, and I appreciate those particular concerns. But the rhetoric and the language within which it was framed created a kind of measure of authenticity or cultural legitimacy against which the indigenous culture could only be true if it was frozen and locked in the past. Or the late Justice Alan McEachran, in his initial decision with the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en case, which has gone down in legal history as Delgamuukw. In that case, he found at one point that essentially this was not a question of the infringement of an indigenous nation's sovereignty, but rather a question of poverty. And furthermore, proof that these were not so much people who had a culture and a society, etc., that was any different, they drove pickup trucks, drank pop, and ate pizza. That's in his decision. I don't have it quite in the order in which he had it. He actually puts that into his decision. Of course, he was helped with that by a government expert witness called Sheila Robertson, who actually provided that text that allowed him to then make his decision. It's the way judicial decisions are rendered. It's premised upon a notion about cultural authenticity. These kinds of critiques. Both positive and negative visions held by environmentalists tend to place indigenous peoples within nature and outside of history. Of course, environmentalists, it's unfair to label all our environmentalists this way, or to somehow say this is unique to environmental movements. It's not. It's part of a colonial structure, and the environmental movement, of one sense, emerges out of the colonial structure. Doesn't mean it's locked within the dynamics of colonialism, but I think it's important to note that some of these ideas are part of a general structure of ideas, and unless people recognize them and understand them, it creates problems. And where you actually see the kind of colonial enactment occur within the environmental movement is when an indigenous community deviates from the expected ecological Indian role, and then there is a massive weight of finances, political pressure, etc., brought down to try to bring that nation into line. And there's been some examples at various points in time. And questions you can ask me about that. Now, in the struggle, however, to regain and assert control over traditional territories, as I mentioned, many First Nations in BC have seen it useful to enter into short-term tactical alliances with the growing environmental movement. And irrespective of their different long-term strategic aims, the immediate interests of both groups have coalesced around halting the depletion of BC's natural resources by transnational corporations. So you find that there is an actual short-term goal in linking up. You have a whole range of these, as I said, over the course of BC, basically really heating up in the 1980s. There were some movements before that, but there's a whole range of things from the Tsleil-Waututh, which has been in the news at the Tsleil-Waututh decision in the last summer, finding Aboriginal title to land, which is one of the first court cases that actually has resolved that particular question. In the Stein Valley area, just north of the lower mainland, the Carmana Valley, the Walbrun, the Clackwood Sound in the 90s, a whole range of these kind of struggles bouncing around. Of course, Lyell Island and Mears Island, Lyell Island on Queen Charlotte Island, Hawaii, which kick-started the creation of a national park, the Guayanas National Park, Mears Island, which was one of the real, in around Tofino, West Coast Vancouver Island, one of the kick-starting areas that really propelled the movement to the linkage between indigenous and environmental movements. Those move forward, and we see now the arriving up of around the pipeline issues, the Trans-Canada pipeline down here, the Kinder Morgan pipeline, and then the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline. Though it's quite likely that the Northern Gateway pipeline will be held up in legal actions for a decade or two or more before anything really, truly actually happens. And it's quite likely economic role processes will take play before any actual ground is broken in any significant way, I suspect, on that one. So I'm just going to give you a quick snapshot overview of some of the economic background, and then we're going to come back to the development of British Columbia's economy and then come back to the environmental non-Aboriginal alliance, environmental Aboriginal alliances. I think it's important to recognize and understand that British Columbia came into the global capitalist economy in a different way than other parts of British Columbia, of Canada and North America did. So, depending upon the point of time of which this expansion outward occurred in incorporation, there are different things happened. The early, when Christopher Columbus and the Spanish came over and the Portuguese in Central and South America, you see one type of colonialism tied to a feudal structure where they were basically interested in just ripping the resources out of the countryside as best they could. And anyone who's in history would know that that little sentence is a massive oversimplification and summation of an extensive period of time. But it's because we're not dwelling on it here. As you move up in time into the 1700s, late 1700s, we start to see a kind of change in dynamics. So in 1776, you have the American Civil War, the separation of the American 13 colonies from the British Crown. One of the key issues, from our perspective, looking at indigenous issues, was that the Crown had tried with the 1763 proclamation to lock the colonies in to the eastern seaboard, basically by asserting the Crown's control over everything to the west of those 13 colonies that were there. Now, I know the normal narrative is to focus upon tea parties and things like that, but from an indigenous rights perspective, from looking at the expansion of colonialism across North America, actually that situation is far more relevant. The fact also that around the same period of time is exactly when the English finally beat the French into place and took control and settled that sort of imperial problem they had fighting with the French, and they were in supreme control basically over North America, and then they could turn their attentions to their colonies that were getting a little bit out of hand. The ones that became Canada had been more compliant and had a different kind of historical relationship with the Crown than the 13 who actually went and became the U.S. But at that moment in time, just a little bit after, you see four groups of Europeans on the west coast of Canada starting to emerge. Three were engaged in trade. One was really more engaged in trying to quietly assert or continue its believed sovereignty in that area. The Spanish, coming up from San Blas. Has anyone ever been to San Blas? No? Many, many years ago, when I was barely in my 20s, my partner and I went down there and had a holiday. And then, much to our surprise, seeing all these old military fortresses and stuff around that town, which was then, at that time, a kind of local tourist place. And then later, reading the archives and the ship's logs about how that had been the Spanish imperial base on the Pacific. Major, and a lot of the, Quadra, Malaspina, Camano, Valdez, all these guys came out of that harbor, that port, coming up this coast, exploring. Now, they were attempting to control. This is part of the legal fiction of part of Spanish control. But they'd really essentially ignored this area for Mexico and mid-southern California. And they really weren't able to hold themselves into this space. The Russians were coming down across the Bering Sea, coming down. They were actively engaged in trade and actively engaged in massive warfare with the indigenous communities with a whole range of different techniques and technologies. And then coming into what they amounted to the great ground in between were the sort of New England traders coming out of the U.S. who had just basically been finished cutting their teeth against the British and being successful, and the British boats coming connected sometimes with East Indian trading companies, but essentially coming out of major merchant networks coming across into this area. And so you have basically in British Columbia, the Americans and the British fighting it out for control over the maritime fur trade and forging various different alliances with the local indigenous communities. And in this kind of context, you had what you might call the articulation of a mercantile form of capitalism with an indigenous mode of production or economic system that was based upon a hierarchical rank society of chiefly society. And there was a coming together, a form of alliances, an economic tactical alliance between these wayward British and American traders that are coming through this area. Because you have to imagine, you're on about a 50-foot boat. Let's see. And that's just it. You know, a 50-foot boat is a 50 feet. Am I right in guessing from this corner to that corner might be about 50 feet? What do you guys think? Or 20 meters, 30 meters? Close enough? Well, just imagine if we took about 40 of you and squeezed you. What's your name in the back, sir?
Booth?
Chris?
Yeah.
So between Chris and I, we squeezed you in, and then from you, please, you're?
Glenda.
From Glenda and say Adam, and squeeze everybody in this room, maybe we can put about 15 of you overboard. That's where you live as you did for 2 years, mostly men, in fact, all men. There's all kinds of delightful accounts about these guys losing their clothes when they took the clothes off between, because they only had the below deck sailors only had two changes of clothes for the entire time they were there. So it was quite something to lose their clothes when they would go ashore and clean their clothes, and then one of the local groups would pick them up and steal them. So you imagine, this other, just another piece of little kind of interesting, I find, olfactory trivia, that the indigenous communities constantly complained about the way these guys smell. Of course, the Europeans weren't any politer. I mean, they wrote down in their journals about how the villages stunk to high heaven as well. But there is this cultural coming together of different types of senses, notions of disgust and distaste coming into that. One of my favorite accounts is the way in which when people first saw rice, molasses, and pilot biscuits, actually a most gruesome conceptualized conception of a meal, to be honest, because it's been on the book for a long time. When they saw the rice poured, they looked at them like, God, they're serving us maggots. And they're pouring on top of it the rendered grease of dead people. And we're going to eat it with these. I don't know if you've ever seen the bracket fungus in the woods. You know, they grow in the trees. And they're serving us that to chew on. And they said, but we're polite. We're going to accept this, because to reject this would be to say something rude to them. And so there's a whole issue around the intersection around food and the coming together and these notions of forming alliances. And this is trying to make sense of what the other people are doing. And of course, when they realized that these are just other human beings, they're just as fallible, had some interesting tools, they kind of shifted things. But these guys in these boats realized, oh my God, there's like 40 or 50 of us, mostly, on this tiny little boat. We keep bumping our bottom on the rocks and stuff all the time. We've got to go ashore. There's hundreds and hundreds of people around us. They're not particularly keen on us being here. We've got to form some kind of alliance. So you had these tactical alliances back and forth, and they also had some of the saving skippers try to curry favor with particular groups and maintain them in their favor versus other groups, and which actually contributed to a whole sort of boiling disruption and shifting around the local politics as well. To a certain extent, it shifted the power bases in the community seaward, because what it did, the most seaward groups were the ones from about 1780s through to the 1830s were the ones most able to gain access to the new technology in terms of steel. Steel far more important than the guns. The early guns were interesting, but if you had a proper indigenous type of armor that people had at the time, heavy leather skins with interlaced with bone, etc., the muskets really weren't any stronger than the arrows that people have. And also there's a slow period of time. If you ever seen one of these old guns and you try to actually load it to fire it and get the flint in place and everything, and if there is somebody charging at you with a blood-curdling looking weapon, you're going to have steel, nerves of steel, or you probably will fumble. All right. So you can imagine this context. So the weapons themselves weren't necessarily an advantage. So they did start to shift the trade, because it's quite impressive to shoot something down, you know, a tiny, almost imperceptible object from a long distance. That is an intriguing work of magical technology. So that period basically rolled us through about the 1850s thereabouts, and you start seeing a shift in the change of this economy where it mattered. When I mentioned the other day about the importance of controlling fish and labor power. So when you start to develop the industrial extraction economy, it became really important to control labor power and the resources. Previously, the key thing to control, the most important things to control, were the alliances and access points to trading nodes on the coast. So you see both a shift in the economic structure and a shift in the possibilities of the likelihood of different types of alliances emerging. And it's in this period of time where you start seeing some of the trade union movements emerging later on in the province and the trade union alliances that I talked a little bit about last day. But of course, that resource economy essentially, and I'm doing this, is what anthropologists love to do this, we jump historical periods and epochs without blanching, without blushing, without anything. We have no qualms with doing it. So I'm jumping right into the 1970s, the period of industrial rationalization, concentration. You get this massive shift where you have this introduction, a couple things are happening. You get this new technology in terms of manufacturing processing, roboticization, mechanization of the production lines. One of my brother-in-laws used to work as a summer relief worker up at Houston Forest Products in the 80s. They had something called a green chain then. I don't think green chains exist anymore. And I'm not even going to go into details describing, but there's a whole bunch of different jobs. But even while he was doing that, while he was doing his own undergraduate in the mid-1980s, the productivity of that mill did something like increased by about 2.5 times, and the workforce dropped by about 70%. So you could produce more finished products, fewer people, quicker time. It also means you need more raw timber, more raw fiber. It means you really need fewer mills, again, fewer jobs. There's this whole process is going where the economy is controlling and collapsing. At the same time, you see the rise, partly as a response to the environmental movement, of ecotourism opportunities, a new type of tourism that was coming in, different types of activities where we now start valuing the outdoor world as a commodity to market in terms of the experience. And it is a beautiful place to go. I gotta tell you, some of the best places and the most amazing places in this world are on the coastline of northern BC, or you go up to the Bella Coola Valley, or you go up to the north, and part like around Atland and beyond, up there to Stewart or up to the northeast. Even in areas where these boreal forests, because I'm biased, I'm coastal oriented, you go up to these boreal forests, and even if you turn your eyes and look away from where the oil and gas lines are ripping through the woods, it's phenomenal countryside. And so there's a good reason for people to want to go there. But this new economy starts to emerge, which now needs to have a different kind of setting to market, to sell its commodity than the old industrial resource extraction economy. And so it's both, you get a conflict in terms of there is, needs a different type of setting, and secondly, it employs more people than does the old industrial economy. And in fact, the industrial economy is diminished to such a point that it's very unlikely you will find in today's university class people who will have an opportunity to do summer employment in one of the industrial plants, whether it's fishing, forestry, agriculture, or whatever. That whole sector of this economy has totally changed. And the final point is that, of course, we are two different, in a sense, BC is really, in a sense, two economies. There's the lower mainland economy, which is a completely different one. It's connected in different flows of traffic, though it is the command center for the rest of the province. And then the rest of the province, which is a kind of resource hinterland, except the primary resource today, it's still conflicted, but it's that extraction of that resource today requires fewer people. One other quick example, Banks Island, an island in Kikatla territory, there's a small gold mine. And I say small, it's not small by dollar value or production-wise, it's small by number of people, and even by the impact it's laying on the ground there. They just recently declared, I forget the specific legal technology, but basically they've broken a profit. And so in certain mining regulation, because you're publicly traded, you have the certain points when you hit that you have to make a public announcement. It just recently became commercially viable, as it were, in this kind of break-even point. There might be 30, 40 people maximum. You go back in that same region about 70, 80 years ago, there was an equivalent kind of mine,
way lower efficiency in terms of extraction. It basically blasted big holes in the ground and ripped everything out and had dams and tailings and things like that. Nothing like the interior of the province when we hear about the Mount Pauley barrier break and the sort of tailings pond break. These are still smaller scale mines. And that, that big mine, just I think it was near a surf inlet, has something like 200 or 300 people working at it up until somewhere around the 30s or 40s. So there's these different changes in scale. So the volume that's coming out of the Banks Island mine in terms of raw is quite good. The other thing that's coming, things like wind power, another major extraction, the oil and gas transportation lines are going. Okay. So that's the base of economy, and that sure shifts the dynamics and the players at stake. The other thing that's happened through this period of time is that through most of the late 1900s to the mid-20th century, indigenous community members were heavily involved in the resource extraction industries, with the exception of mining, and that's a whole different issue. But by and large, through forestry, agriculture, fisheries, throughout the province, indigenous communities were heavily embedded as labor force in those sectors. Since the 70s and the concentration of production and shifting, Aboriginal participation has decreased disproportionately larger than non-Aboriginal participation. So jobs have been going further, but the displacement of Aboriginal labor has been at a higher rate than non-Aboriginal in all these sectors, which leaves a lot of younger people without jobs, without the same connection to the resource economy. So if you look at the division between my age in, I won't tell you, but somewhere in the mid-reaches of the century, we all had experience working in industry, either if you're on the coast in fisheries, if you're in the interior somewhere with forestry. Most of the people who are, say, 20, 30 years younger have no such experience, no familiarity, no connection, which also creates a different kind of social orientation possible. Hence, again, another factors that lead to some of the environmental connections and orientations. Making sure that the papers in my hand are at the same place that my speaking is. So, let's take a look at some of the nature of these, and I'm going to talk a little bit about two examples. One is a slightly older one, the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en court case, which is in the 1980s. It's a pivotal case. Actually, the decisions were made in the 1990s. That came from this case. It was a rights and title case, but it really began way back. Our intents and purposes will begin in the 80s. Then I'm going to talk about the contemporary oil and gas struggles that are currently going on, and then we'll pull that to a tidy conclusion. So the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en had sought a declaration from the courts confirming their ownership and jurisdiction over their traditional territories and resources in northwestern British Columbia. So this is an area of I forget exactly, it's the size of a small European nation in terms of its size. So people know where the Hazelton region is? Anyone? A few guys? A few? How about Smithers? Smithers, a little more kind of recognizing Smithers. So if you just kind of think inland from Prince Rupert and seaward from Prince George. People know where Prince George is? The two princes, Prince George, Prince Rupert. Good. The regular crew know where that is? No, okay. So Prince George is if you drive up to the interior, it's about 1,000 kilometers from Vancouver, kind of going a little bit to the east and north. And then if you were to drive between Prince Rupert and Prince George, come together, well, not exactly in the middle, but I think it's rough enough for us to say. And then there's this kind of rectangular looking shape that kind of goes up and down across the highway, which is, loosely speaking, the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en's traditional territories. Okay. Now, community-wise, this is an interesting grouping because they are on the one side of their kind of combined community, Tsimshian people who speak a language of the coast, the Gitsan,
And then the Wet'suwet'en are actually from an interior carrier community with a totally different language. Yet these two communities have kind of come together in interesting ways, speak different languages, have slightly different practices and cultures. But it's kind of an interesting thing about this. One kind of neat little tape audio interview I listened to one time, a man called Donald Gray was being interviewed. This is 1962, I believe, 61 or 62. He was being interviewed by the anthropologist Wilson Duff. Wilson Duff is now passed away. He used to work here at UBC in the museum. He worked in Victoria in the Museum of BC. But Mr. Gray begins his interview with Wilson Duff sitting up in Hagelbeck, which is near the Hazeltons. It's a Wet'suwet'en community right on a river there. And he begins by saying, "I'm really sorry, Mr. Duff. I only speak 9 languages, not like the old people used to speak." Right there is a very interesting one. "I only speak 9. Now, there's a kind of sense of humility with that, so there's an element of structured humility. But the point is, we're talking about communities with this polyvocality, where it was not unusual for people of importance and position to speak more than just 1, 2, 3, 4, but 9 different languages. Very, very important. Hagelbeck also was at a kind of crossroads, a confluence, an intersection zone. But across the indigenous BC, you would see this kind of structure. So anyway, I merely mention that because it says something about the ways in which people maintain diversity, linguistic diversity. Very often in our modern world, we think, well, everyone's exposed to each other. We all divulge to the same common language. Well, we have done that in our societies, but it doesn't have to be that way. We can actually maintain linguistic diversity even while we're interacting with people who speak different languages. It just means we learn a couple languages, which if we start young enough, it's not a problem. Those of us who are ancient, well, it's a little different issue. And I only speak of myself when I say ancient. So, you have the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en attempting to seek a declaration from the court. I've mentioned Ellen McEachran in his first decision. He states here, so McEachran denied the existence of Aboriginal rights in BC, and he said, quote, that the discovery and occupation of this continent by European nations, our occupations and settlement gave rise to a right of sovereignty. So this is the classic line. McEachran's decision gets overturned later on in court, nonetheless. But the First Nations community sees that, says, you know, this isn't the end of it, we're going to keep going. And one of the things that the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en did, which was quite interesting, was forge tactical alliances with different non-Indigenous communities. There were all kinds of support groups that were set up. Sometimes they would come up. And part of the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en's tactical approach, their long-term strategy to achieve their Aboriginal right and title, involved litigation, so using courts. It involved negotiation, sitting down and talking with people. And it also involved direct political action, where they would blockade and stop roads. And a kind of interesting balancing back and forward of these techniques helped move their case along. And one of the things that they would often do was also work with different support groups, different community groups that wanted to support them, who would come and join them on the picket line on blockade, as long as they did so as in a supporter or ally role, as opposed to trying to take control of the blockades. And a lot of the different environmental communities saw this as an avenue of connection and integration. Okay. In the current moment, so that's one example, and I'll just finish that to say that the Gitsan and Wet'suwet'en shifted forward and actually their legal battles transformed the legal definitions about the right to consult. They laid a new framework. Also, another thing that's interesting about them is changed some of the basis of evidence. So now oral testimony, the Canadian courts recognize oral testimony, i.e. the histories and knowledges held by elders as community leaders or hereditary leaders, as being equivalent for evidence in court. Now, this is an important issue because typically this would fall into the category of hearsay, and hearsay evidence is not allowed, i.e.,
I heard Adam tell me that his father said something. And so I say, well, I understand that our community has done this because Adam's father told him this. And so that's hearsay. I did not hear it directly. But what the courts have said now with the Supreme Court decision on the Delgado MOOC is that kind of oral evidence is important. You do not need to test it against external evidence, because one of the things that McKechnie was doing with the and listening to the government witnesses that were testing it and saying, well, there's a discrepancy between the oral account. When we compare it to Peter Ogden's journal, it says such and such, and well, Chief Joe over here, he's got the story a little befuddled, therefore his story can't be true. Only Ogden. Of course, they didn't want to discuss that the Hudson Bay guys may have had some biased opinions that they wrote down. And that wasn't considered because it was the archive. After this court, the Delgado court decision, it determined that oral evidence is critically important. And then we won't go, there's a whole string of court cases that elaborates and expands what that means. We'll leave that to where it lies. In the contemporary moment, we have a whole range of new types of alliances. And if we take what's happened with the Northern Gateway, for example, people know about the Northern Gateway? See some nods. So this major pipeline that wants to move tar sands from Alberta across northern BC out to Kitimat and then dump them, load them onto tankers and to transport that overseas. Right from the start, most of the First Nations communities are totally opposed to this. And you can see a whole range of different tactics and strategies. So, Gitgat, or Hartley Bay, which is right at the mouth where the tankers come out of Douglas Channel, has had a long history of alliances with different environmental, non-governmental organizations. They're involved in the Coastal First Nations group. In fact, one of their political leaders who married a woman from Hartley Bay, he's actually from the Gitsan, he's from up the interior, Art Sterrett, is the head of Coastal First Nations. And they've deployed for quite some time now a kind of environmental activist international campaign as part of their program. Kakatla took a completely different tactic, and partly because, this is the way history works, about a decade or so earlier, they signed an agreement with a fish farming company. And the environmentalists, like David Suzuki, came to the community. In fact, there's one case where he actually arrived at the dock and he was greeted by a number of hereditary leaders in her regalia who very politely turned him around, put him back on the plane and sent him into town. He said, "That's, we don't tell us how to run our business. We're happy to listen to you, we're happy to take your support, but don't tell us how to run our business." So there was quite a long going from about the early 90s through to about 2010 or so, a massive and concerted campaign to try to compel, of course, Kakatla to stop the fish farms. And it wasn't until the provincial government basically decided that they wouldn't extend fish farm licenses north of the where they currently are in Kitisou territory in mid-coast, we really would expand beyond the Broken Island area, which is still a problem for a lot of people in that part of the country. On a personal note, if you've ever had farmed salmon, it's the most abysmal, horrid tasting fish you can ever imagine. I'm biased. I'm going to lay it right out there. I have, as a point of comparison, tasted wild Atlantic Irish salmon. And I was quite surprised. I wasn't willing to accept that Atlantic salmon could taste good until I actually had a wild one. The farm stuff is really an abysmal substitute. It's kind of like the feedlot equivalent of the fish world. So I'm going to restrain these comments about food preference and things like that. So anyway, Kakatla, for better or for worse, entered into this agreement, and the environmental movement agencies that provide the foundations and grants said, you either repudiate that agreement, or we won't fund you, period. And so Kakatla said, we've been here for millennia. We plan to be here for more millennia. Big deal. And went forward. So when they went when the community leadership then took the Enbridge issue, they mounted what could be called a rights-based challenge to Enbridge. That means that rather than using an environmental action plan campaign, rather than using a social impact assessment, which says, well, if there was a spill, how would it affect our community? What they argued instead, what the community leadership argued instead, forget about all this. You pass through our territories on our authority and jurisdiction, period. You have to talk to us, you have to ask our permission, and it's up to us to decide on our terms whether or not you do this. And so what was mounted was the extent of a legal rights and title claim mounted in terms of the evidence. And if you go on the Joint Review Panel registry, you'll find thousands and thousands of documents and pages filed by Kakatla compared to some of the other First Nations that didn't take this approach. It uses a different, either a social impact approach, or some of them use the argument of the environmental science argument. In the sense that what Kakatla's leadership argued, if you take this environmental science argument and you try to pick apart the science, you've essentially accepted the situation. So it's an interesting conceptual model. But of course, court battles are expensive, and no community can actually carry this alone. And so what you've seen emerge over the last few years is a concerted campaign, because what the environmental organizations realized, we actually can't move forward against Enbridge if we don't somehow have First Nations agreeing to support us or form an alliance with us. So this is actually quite an interesting shift around from sometimes where it was like the First Nations going and asking the environmental movements to help them out in the early period of some of the logging issues. This was actually a turnaround where the environmental movement said, we have to come to you and ask you, because legally speaking, the only thing that will stop Enbridge is the issue of rights and title. Of course, it leaves open the door at the end of the day. What happens if a particular nation that's part of the coalition that's formed that includes beyond just the coastal but some of the interior decides now they have their jurisdiction and authority recognized, they're happy to have the pipeline go over their territory. So that's a different question which we will address later on. One of the ideas of talking through these issues in this way today is to try to draw out the fact that the decisions that people make in their everyday are structured but not constrained by the nature of the economic situation within which we're located. So back in the fur trading period, the type of economic decisions, the social decisions, were framed through that kind of interaction between fur trading. In the fish canneries, in the logging plants, in the logging camps, or probably the sawmills and the logging camps, the pulp mills, the relationships became struggles over the conditions of work that people faced, and people saw this as a common dynamic. And as that industry shifted and changed, and even though economically speaking it still contributes to this province at a significant level, it doesn't have the same employment, as it shifts and changes into this world in which we see environmental values being a key driving force, and then the movement of energy exports as emerging, you see that the environmental type organizations to form alliances need First Nations to sign on with them. And that actually changes the dynamic. In the same way, business joint ventures, which I again didn't get to, we will though at some point in this course, business joint ventures are a recognition on the part of the non-Indigenous community that they actually require First Nations agreement and participation in order to move their particular enterprises forward. Whether it's an environmental challenge of a federal government decision to allow a bulk export pipeline, or it might be a mine approval in a particular area that will employ people, First Nations agreement and participation has now become required by the changes in the economic structure and the legal basis that has emerged over time. See you all on Wednesday.